Our topic is called Worship and Welcoming the Stranger. What page do we have in the notebook?
Seven.
All right, I didn't grab my notebook, so I hope I stay close to the outline. If I don't, well, at least we'll get you the information. Folks, let me tell you something about worship. There is no way you can, with words, describe worship. Worship is something you experience. Now, I'll feebly try to describe worship the best I can, but I'll tell you this, it's the toughest one of all. But nonetheless, it is the number one predictor of growth and decline. Do you folks remember that from last night? I'm going to tell you, developing quality worship service is absolutely priority one. It's not the only priority, but it's the top priority. And what is the target audience you're trying to reach? There you go. Remember last night we gave you a composite picture of the most receptive folks today, 20 to 39, married and have two kids, 6 to 11, right? But let me narrow this down and also show you that there's another group you need to be equally concerned about, because actually the strongest predictor of growth and decline is the 20 to 29 age range. Now, I want you to look at those folks. They're different, all right? And especially, you got to take the fact that this is some urban area, and every area will have some uniqueness about it. You better know the people you're trying to reach. The number one reason these people will come to your worship service is because, and this is what they tell us, is because a member invited them. That's the number one reason a person will show up at a worship service. They were invited by a member of the church. But the number one reason they're going to come back is due to the quality of the worship service. Bottom line. And I want to tell you something. When they come, they are not looking just to hear more about God. They're wanting to be ushered into the presence of God. And if I had one word that will help you understand what people are looking for today, is experience. Because our cultural situation with media and all of the various changes we discussed last night, people are experiencing, interacting. Therefore, when they come to worship, they're expecting also to find some element of experience. I wish that I could have every one of you to be with me last Sunday. I was in Oklahoma City at the Northeast Church of Christ. But you and I stood out like a sore thumb. All of us would have. This was a black congregation. And I had an experience of a lifetime. You know, they have a very different tradition, but we can learn from them. I sat through a 2-hour and 45-minute worship service. And I didn't even look at my watch for 2.5 hours. I'm telling you, it was so interactive, so vibrant, so exciting. It was like nothing I'd ever seen. Now, they didn't invite me to tell them about worship. They knew they had it. They needed to know how in the world they were going to assimilate these hundreds of people showing up, all ages. I mean, just packing this place out. So we were talking about small groups. But I got a chance to experience it. I want to tell you, folks, when they sang, men and women would pat their feet to the beat, and I want to tell you, the floors vibrated. It was something you could experience. They had it lined up where people would stand up and give their testimonies and answered prayer, interactive. They had time where people would come down and share their prayer request, and everybody's prayer request was taken. And I tell you, I heard a song leader, and I've never heard a song leader like it in my entire life. I mean, he alone could have made the singing fabulous. But when he brought in several hundred people, over 400 in with him, I'm telling you, the walls kind of shook. Now, the point I wanted you to see, and I'm not suggesting that you plan 2.5-hour worship services, because let me tell you, you're not African American, all right? You better just accept who you are, and you need to target an hour and 15, and I mean an hour and a half. You're pushing your luck, all right? Okay. You know, when we talk about worship, or when we talk about church growth, People have some of the wildest ideas imaginable. They think about gimmicks and doing bizarre things. Even the things that I explained to you in this black worship service was nothing bizarre. It was really an exciting, meaningful, interactive kind of experience. I came across this cartoon. It sort of expresses how people think when you say church growth or when you think about, you know, contemporary worship. Let me show you this little cartoon. See the fella up here? The guy's talking to him. Pastor, we've put up with praise choruses, worship bands, interpretive dance, and you're preaching in blue jeans, but we draw the line at bungee baptisms. Well, I want to assure you, I am not trying to promote anything that's gimmickry. I am trying to promote genuine, meaningful worship service in the context of the needs of today's culture. Culture has changed. We need to understand their needs. Where to touch them, okay? First off, I want to start off giving you the purpose of the assembly. All right? There's a threefold purpose. If you got your Bibles, you can follow along or you can just listen to me as I read. And I'm going to go to 1 Corinthians 14. But let me ask you, just right off the top of your head, you know, when we come to the assembly, what are we here to do? Worship. Worship God. That's the first and most important thing we're here to do. Worship God. All right? That's fine. We know that. God should be given His due. But I want to take you to 1 Corinthians 14 because as Paul is talking to these Corinthians, they were making some major error in their worship service. Okay? They were blowing it big time. So let's go to verse 26 and look at another of the threefold purposes of worship. Now it is then, brethren, when you come together, each of you has a psalm, has a teaching, has a tongue, has a revelation, has an interpretation. Let all things be done for what? Edification. In other words, listen, we're to worship God, but the way we do it is to build us up, not bore us down. Do you hear that? It's to build us up. It's to edify us. Now, the challenge we're going to see in a little bit later is what edifies one age group. Remember our pre-war, post-war dilemma? Sometimes is not what builds up another group and vice versa. So we're going to have to deal with that a little bit. Believe it or not, there are some people who believe that the worship service is just for Christians. It's for us four no more. I don't know if you've ever heard that. You might even said that yourself one time or another. But let's let the Word of God get you to rethink this a little bit. Because there's a clear implication if you back up, beginning in verse 23 of 1 Corinthians 14, Paul now is correcting the abuses of worship by the Corinthians, collective worship. He says, therefore, if the whole church comes together in one place and all speak with tongues, and there come in those who are uninformed or unbelievers, will they not say that you're out of your mind? There's an implication there. Hang on. There's an implication there. But if all prophesy and an unbeliever or an uninformed person comes in, he is convinced by all, he is convicted by all, and thus by the secrets of his heart are revealed, and so falling down on his face, he will worship God and report that God is truly among you. What implication do you see?
Visitors.
You expect visitors. The church worship is not just for Christians, it is to be inclusive of the outsider. Isn't that just what Paul said? You don't do this in such a way that pleases you. You do it in a way that can include the outsider. They don't think you're nuts, but they can gain something out of it. But I'm going to tell you what, this is one of the most ignored principles in Christianity anywhere because we're totally convinced worship is for us and how we do it ought to just please us and meet the needs that we have. But John 4 and 23, God is seeking more what? True worshipers, that's right. And that means visitors are often a very critical component and point of reaching those that don't know. So, the threefold purpose, worship God. But let me tell you what. Every culture has the freedom to worship differently. There is no right or wrong basic style of worship. I don't expect people in Mexico to worship like people in America. Do you? Do you expect people in Russia to worship exactly like people in Peru? Do you? But now what we've got is we've got diversity like that even in our country. Okay? Europe has understood this principle all along. They've understood diversity. But we've had a monocultural expression. But now everybody is accentuating ethnic diversity and even diversity among age groups. So now we've got the challenge of trying to make this relevant to as many people as possible. Now, this is not a new development. Worship was to be inclusive from the beginning. Now, let me walk through it real quick because I outlined this for you in the first chapter of Church Growth Through Groups. I deal with this issue. Abraham, beginning in Genesis 12 and verse 3, God blesses Abraham and says to Abraham, And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. He said, I'm going to make you a blessing, you'll be a blessing. Through you all the families of the earth will be blessed. Through Abraham is to bless just the Jews? The whole world, right? But we know through Abraham's descendants, Israel was born as a nation, right? Even Israel, as exclusionary as they were violating the principles that God taught. Because if you will look at Isaiah 42 and 6, Isaiah says to Israel, you are to be a light unto the nations, not just an isolated group of clean people. And when Solomon gave his inaugural speech dedicating the temple in 1 Kings 8, 41 to 43, he makes the proclamation that this is the house of God in which the nations can flow into it and worship the true God. In other words, Israel was not to even exclude the stranger in their worship. And Jesus tells us himself, Luke 19:10, I came to seek and save what? The lost. Now, is that just the lost of the house of Israel? No, because you turn to Matthew 28 and 19 and 20, he passes the Great Commission over to the church, and he says, how far should we go to make disciples? Unto all the nations. Pante ethne, to all the ethnic groups of the world. The gospel is for all. Now I want to give you the fascinating thing. I'm going to tell you what, if you haven't studied some of the cultural context, this can kind of blow some people away. But I want to give you the cultural context for inclusion. The social, political, and economic structure of the first century was so different than what we live today, it would shock you to go back in those times. A lot of people think, boy, it'd be just like it is today. They'd probably open their King James Bible, meet at their church buildings. It was so different, you would probably not even feel like it was a Church of Christ. Because the social, economic, and political structure was households. In America, it is individuals. And the individual family. But what literally formed society was people that were like matriarchs, patriarchs, their family, their relatives, their co-workers, their servants, their slaves. They formed households. And listen, you couldn't survive economically in the first century outside of a household. People didn't live individualism. There were no radical individuals in the first century because they didn't have a society structure that would promote that. You survive in a household. Are you with me? And you need to study that and look at that because it was so different the way people identified themselves with one another. And then what you find is that when the church began, the church found its existence being formed by households. Passages like this, Romans 16, 3-5, Priscilla and Aquila, my fellow workers in Christ, who for my life laid down their own necks, unto whom not only I give thanks, but all the churches of the Gentiles, and I salute the church that is in their house. Not just in their house, in their household. Okay? Churches met in households. You can look at 1 Corinthians 16:19, Colossians 4:15, Philemon 2. Now, what confuses us many times is when we look at the Corinthian church, we see that the whole church meets together. So we think, oh, the church was just one big group. Not so. If you will understand contextually what was happening, everything was around households. And then when you had small cities like Corinth, then the households occasionally would come together as a citywide gathering of the church. But the real heart of life was in the household, not in a collective gathering. Okay? But now, that's the first dimension I want you to see of the culture. But here's of the cultural condition. Here's the second one. Hang on to your hats. They were required by the commandments of God to practice an ancient virtue called hospitality. In their households, they were eager to bring an outsider into their household. And in fact, men would stand at the gate, sit at the gate in a city. And if they saw a stranger from afar, they would run and fall down and say, "Please stay at my house." Why would they do that? They had been taught that God had opened up His household to them. And so if we are to have the same kind of qualities as God, who allowed us into His family, therefore then we should show the same hospitality to strangers as well. Hebrews, the passage you're familiar with, Hebrews 13:2. The Hebrew writer tells the Christians, don't forget to show hospitality to strangers, because what might you do? You might entertain angels unaware. Why, isn't that exactly what Abraham did? He saw the men coming at a distance, and he ran and said, "Oh, please, rest at my tent." And the hospitality was shown. Now, get this. Now, catch this clearly, because this is going to show you a whole different mindset that we've got to overcome that the early churches had naturally. These men who were householders, where the church met in their homes, were out inviting strangers into their homes to stay. And then, guess where worship was held? In their home. And guess who would be there? The visitors. The strangers. So it was a natural thing for the early church to have unchurched visitors in the house and in the worship. And in fact, in essence, early Christians would run to get people to come into their house. You see? Now, if we ever get back to where we're running and begging people to come into our church services and our church activities, we're going to see incredible things happen. You see, that was what was happening in the first century, and I guarantee you that is what is understood when Paul is telling these Corinthians, listen, don't be acting like an idiot, don't be speaking in tongues, literally, do things clearly, because an outsider is going to come in, an outsider is going to be right there among you. You see, that was expected, all right? So, worship is for the stranger as well as for the Christian. So, do you understand the threefold purpose of worship? I wish I had time to show you. I'll try to get into some of the ways we make an extra effort to be exclusionary rather than inclusive. I'll show you some. We do it all the time. But let me develop right now the contemporary attitude that people have outside the church about worship. This has been evaluated and studied extensively. I know this congregation, the Rocky Mountain Church, has done this. But listen, this came my first encounter with the contemporary attitude about contemporary worship goes all the way back to the old Family Feud. Do y'all remember the old Family Feud with Richard Dawson? Remember him? What was it? What was his trademark? Kissing. You can't trust somebody that selectively kisses. Yeah, I know. It seems like it. He wasn't real consistent on that. But anyway, he got your attention. Here's how it would work. He would survey a previous audience. They would bring the survey back to a new audience. These two families would then try to guess the top responses to the survey. Well, on this particular occasion, this literally happened. I was sitting there, and the survey question was, what is the most boring thing? And the survey said, church. That was the very words. I came up out of my seat, literally, too. I mean, so you can get shocked sometimes. I was shocked. Because what was the most meaningful thing to us collectively, worship, young people are saying it's boring. And that is basically what people are experiencing as they have experienced it growing up. It's boring. Now, this has been validated by study after study. If you've looked at Bill Hybels' study in 1975, he went around asking people, why do people not attend church? Here are the top answers. Churches always ask for money. Sermons are boring. Services are routine. Church is irrelevant to life. Preachers make people feel guilty and ignorant. Then Rick Warren in 1980 asked his community the same thing. Sermons are boring, don't relate to life, people are unfriendly, only interested in money, poor child care. Well, I have some of my graduate students for their projects, and one of their options, they can study a church and analyze it, or they can do a survey of unchurched people and ask them, why do people not attend church? Well, Danny McKinney did one. We even put it in Church Growth Magazine a number of years back. In 1990, he interviewed 50 unchurched people, and then 50, and they're all young adults, 50 church attenders. Here were the top reasons they gave. Number one, church is irrelevant, and number two, it's inconvenient. Well, folks, you and I know that whether it's Hybels, Warren, or anybody else, there's not a real truth to this if it's addressed properly. It's only a truth when worship is not a priority in our preparation. Let me give you some reasons. You got down there reasons. Here's some reasons people are evaluating worship in this manner. People in society have dramatically changed. Pre-war, post-war, preference, values, and taste. Friday night. Basically, church culture has stayed the same for an unbelievable number of years. But let me tell you, we basically treasure our antiquated style so much that you are treading on holy ground, such that this cartoon will capture the risk that you have messing around with worship. Can you see this guy right here being taken to the gallows? And these two guys are talking. I tried to tell him not to change the order of service. Hey, you don't think that it won't get you in trouble? Huh. Let me tell you what has happened, folks. We have done our worship strategy the same way for so long that we have theologized our method. Now, let me see if that makes sense to what I'm saying. We've done our tradition so long, members have accepted the fact that it must be the biblically right way, or else we would have probably done it some other way earlier. So we have theologized our methods. The way we worship, our two songs, a prayer, a song, communion, two songs, whatever, sermon, song, that is a traditional pattern. There's no biblical basis for doing that way. You can do it in a variety of ways. God gives us the liberty to do that. Well, the ritualistic way, sometimes members interpret a very predictable pattern as being spiritual and reverent. In other words, some members find real meaning. I'm not saying it's wrong, but I want to contrast it. Having a quiet atmosphere, having a formal atmosphere, and having a very reflective atmosphere by some is interpreted as spiritual. That's okay. That's not wrong. That is a matter of one's personal interpretation. But when young people are asked, evaluate this, they find it formalistic, ritualistic, and boring. In other words, it hits the mind, it doesn't touch the heart. And worship that does not touch the heart will never be able to reach young adults today. That's a bottom line. Okay? So if you want growth as a goal, there's a section there. If you want growth as a goal, you've got to have visitors. All right? You've got to have visitors. And the number one way you're going to have visitors is to invite them. And the only reason they're going to come back is because of the quality and the experience of that worship service. We may not like that, but I'm going to tell you without a shadow of a doubt, that is reality. All right? What I'm saying, adding a heart to worship does not in any way violate any biblical truths. I am not suggesting charismania. I'm not suggesting gimmickry. I am suggesting a style that has some enthusiasm, some life, and some participation in it that helps people feel I've experienced worship as well as mentally participated in worship. All right? Everybody with me so far? Because it's communication here. I don't want to be misunderstood. All right? I don't want you walking away. Man, John's trying to create a charismatic movement here. Far be it. And that's not... Yes? That's where we're headed right now. Okay, so I'm going to share with you some assembly of characteristics of growing churches. All right? Again, you will not find it easy to... I will not find it easy to describe. It must be experienced. You just cannot describe it. So I'm handicapped, but I'm going to try my best, okay? That's why we need to get around and get out of our isolated areas and start experiencing. I tell you, I thank God that I had a chance to experience that black worship service. Yeah, I mean, that was wonderful. And the worship service at my church, from an Anglo perspective, it's one of the best in the country. But you've just got to experience these things. But one of the characteristics is you're going to find they're warm, friendly, and non-judgmental. All right? Warm, friendly, and non-judgmental. When I go in and I ask people in a diagnostic evaluation, tell me what the number one strength of your church is. Do you know what the number one strength they always tell me? Almost 100%. We are a friendly congregation. But I will ask visitors, you know, give me an evaluation. And in many cases, the visitors will say, boy, this is a cool, aloof, unfriendly congregation. Do you know what? They're both right. How can that be?
Friendly to each other.
You got it. They're friendly among themselves and they ignore the stranger. They don't take into account the stranger. You got it. We have a struggle here. I'm going to tell you, I came across this little illustration. In Churches of Christ, we really do have a challenge to be friendly. Can you see the announcements being made here? And the guy says, until next Sunday, remember, God loves you, I love you, and Brother Al here is working on it. Well, let me tell you, there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And we'll give you some suggestions here. A sister came up to me, and I hope she won't mind me using this illustration. A lady came up and said, you know, I'm a single. And I can be warm and friendly to singles that are females, but I feel a little reservation about being warm and outgoing to a single who's a male. And that's normal. I understand that. But let me give you a little observation I shared with her. We need to stop looking at male, female, or whatever, and start realizing and visualizing, this is my home. How would I treat a visitor in my home? Would I ignore any visitor in my home? And if you'll look at it that way, that'll change your whole mindset. You don't have to worry about being forward or too overgoing. You can never be too friendly. Okay? You can never be too friendly. In fact, in McKinney's study, he asked, after they said why they didn't go to church, he said, what would you look for in a church if you were going to find one? And here was their number one response. I would look for a friendly, and that's one part, friendly, and notice this, loving fellowship. That's two qualities. Friendly and loving fellowship. All right, that says I'm looking for a friendliness, but I'm also wanting something else. This actually happened. I was talking about being friendly and the efforts that a church needs to go to actually organize friendliness. An elder came up to me and told me this true story. He said, John, we were working so hard at being friendly and we got us some greeters out there and they were doing a great job. And a lady came in and visited us for the first time. And one of the new greeters went up and shook her hand and said, we're so glad to have you. Thank you for coming. We hope you find this a friendly church. And the lady's response was this. I'm not looking for a friendly church. I'm looking for a friend. Powerful message, people. You better be a friendly church because you don't usually extend friendship without friendliness. But that's not all. They're looking for some meaningful connection in your congregation. And to the degree that you can connect, to that degree you'll keep them. We'll talk about that some more. Okay? We'll deal with it. Let me offer you some basics, all right? If your church doesn't have greeters, you might as well consider that you can't even do the basics like dribble a basketball and trying to be a basketball player. How many of you have greeters? Okay, that's a fundamental. Basically, you want to have some outgoing young adult greeters. And you want to have greeters to be friendly. You know, do you register your visitors? You better find a way to register your visitors. And you need a visitation program. Any of you do? How many of you do visitation? Oh, we're back to the fundamentals. If you don't greet, register, and visit, you can't even dribble the ball to make the shot. Now, I know what all the literature is about. I hear people saying, okay, you know, unchurched people want anonymity. But let me tell you, they're being reevaluating this. On one end, there are church people who are looking for a home. On the other end, there are unchurched people. And yes, the unchurched people want a little bit more room. But Willow Creek has even decided they have made a mistake by taking such an off-hands approach to reaching out to the unchurched. So you need to find a way to follow up within 24 hours at a minimum within visitation. And I would encourage you to have at least two friend days a year. How many of you have friend days where you encourage your members to invite? A minimum of two, but what you're doing is trying to get them to invite the entire time, okay? And another thing is, you need a non-judgmental atmosphere. You've got to have people that are not so concerned. I'll give you one quick example. A minister worked hard. I mean, he was working so hard with a fella filling station, inviting him to church, totally unchurched. So he got the fellow to come. So he came to church, but he wore a Budweiser t-shirt. All right? This is an unchurched person. All right? One of the members decided it was his responsibility to tell this young man, we want you to know that that is inappropriate attire for church. Needless to say, the fella did not come back. Except, let me tell you then the story. After the preacher discovered what he did, I mean, he chewed this fella out one way and up, one way down the other, and had him go back to the filling station and basically, you know, apologize to the young man. And they were able to get him back, and finally he was baptized. Folks, when you're trying to reach the lost, you cannot be judgmental. You must be willing to be gracious. Let me ask this. Can you be non-judgmental and still hold firm to doctrinal moral stances? My question was, did Jesus? Absolutely. Okay. We got to move quickly. How much time do I have? I have another half an hour? No. Contemporary music. 40% or more of what goes on in worship is music. Now remember, what determines the preference for music type? What they experienced growing up, their generations. Well, folks, the 60s music changed from just hearing an experience to literally a moving experience. And in fact, you can stop. And if a boombox pulls up beside you, do you hear it? You feel it. You got it. So you've got a whole new ball game. If I could stretch out here without wrecking everything, I'm going to get a songbook. I'm going to tell you something about your songbooks. And this is a typical songbook in 90% of Churches of Christ. It's a great songbook in many ways, but I want you to realize something. Most of the songs were written before 1900. Ladies, how would you like to have all of your kitchen utensils to be of the type of the night of 100 years old? Okay? Not only that, most of the songs are based on a quarter note. The music young people are listening to is an eighth note. Now who knows a beat for me? All right, just out loud do both. Give me a quarter beat. No, out loud. Bump, 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 bump. But now give me an eighth note. Bump, 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 bump. Now give me a quarter note. You see, it literally just puts people to sleep because it's not what they're used to. And not only that, the last thing I want to tell you, Most of the songs that we're singing today are speaking in tongues. Just like the Corinthian church. Because when you start singing about bringing in the sheaves, we'll come rejoicing, bringing in the sheaves, a young urban kid comes in and wonders, why can't these people afford a washer and dryer? That's real. And I tell you, a beautiful song I love. I love this song, but I bet you not 5% of you have a clue what it means. Night with ebon pinion, brooding over the veil. Anybody want to take a shot at it? Do you know, but not many. The deal is, people don't understand. Here's some suggestions. Man, I have seen black folks make this music come alive, okay? So you can take traditional music and make it come alive. I recommend you add some contemporary music that's faster, but if you use this, man, you pick the pace up. I mean, you need the most energetic song leader you can muster. The best song leader is the only song leader you use on Sunday morning, all right? And then try to introduce some new ones. So just some basic suggestions. Let me encourage you. All right. Let me move on. My time's running out. An inspiring message. Listen, Walt Disney had it. Walt Disney says, here is what makes a happening. Laughter and tears. That makes a happening. He realized you can hit the mind, the cognitive, all day long, but never reach the heart. Not till you can touch the emotions of people with the application of the Word, and not till you can touch the humorous aspects in the application of the Word, can you really get to that experience dimension. All right? I believe the best preaching method, this is John Ellis's view, is the Jesus' model. Jesus preached by telling what? Stories. Stories, stories, stories. Yes, we need to preach the Word. We need to exegete and tell people what it means. But then we need to help them see how it applies day by day through stories, through illustration, through humor. It is hard to exegete a passage correctly. That's hard work. But I'm going to tell you what is twice as hard is making it relevant. That is the true communicator. It's not how well you can tell us what it means. It's how well you can show us how we can live it. Remember, they are under stress and they want to know, how can this help me live a better life? So, use Jesus' method. Another one. Definitely understand that young people are coming back and they're concerned about their kids. They want ministry for their kids, so I would encourage you to consider a first-class nursery. It's a minimum. I would consider having first-class Bible class programs. And another thing, I would consider children's worship. Major area. And in fact, beyond worship, I think you will never go wrong by encouraging quality children's ministry in the church. It's not my area of expertise, but I see churches that do a great job with children have lots of young folks. And have a growing dynamic in those churches. Because remember, the composite picture are young married couples, how old? Got kids, how old? 6 to 11. All right, so that shows you that children's ministry is very important. Last thing I want to touch on, we'll wrap this up. Excellence throughout every aspect of the worship service. Excellence is absolutely critical. Folks, a preacher, in most cases, will spend anywhere from 10, 15, and even more hours to prepare the sermons that you receive on Sunday morning. But I have gone into churches and watched the remaining aspect of the worship put together right there on the pew 10 minutes before it started. Tell me that doesn't happen. Tell me you haven't seen that. It's as if, hey, we've done it this way for so long, all we got to do is pick a few songs, pick a few people to participate, and we just ritualistically go with this thing. Everybody knows the order. There's nothing to it. Let me tell you, if we do not break that formalistic, that amateurish approach to worship, we're never going to have the impact on people's lives to to convey to them how vibrant, real, and relevant God is. Because we relay that in our worship. I mean, if our worship is vital, they know that our Christian lives and our Christian message is vital. That all goes hand in hand. All right? So what we need then is preparation and excellence in every way for the worship service. In other words, we ought to spend all week getting our worship service together, getting a theme, getting people prepared, getting this thing so it flows like silk. And we have a high impact in what we do. Nobody is just left to haphance and chance. Everybody fully is prepared and is willing to make a major contribution. When you have the communion, I mean, folks should have thought through, have a time frame, and have an incredibly significant message during that communion. I'm telling you, that's one of the most marvelous things about the worship where I attend. Man, they require you to provide a quality message, just a several minutes long. But I'm telling you what, people get excited when communions come in just because of the messages they hear. We're not talking about ramblings or just quoting Scripture. I'm talking about real messages that bring our minds and our hearts to the communion. It's unbelievable. And by the way, I know I'll upset somebody. We complement our communion with beautiful worship songs. For some people, that's blasphemous because silence is what we think is reverent. But I don't. We simply, it's a matter of personal opinion. I do know unchurched people have not learned how to handle silence. They don't know what to do with it. Now, silence is good. We need silence. There are times for silence. But we need to understand that the unchurched simply don't know what to do with silence. And we can help them, facilitate them in this process. So, hopefully this will kind of give you some insight. We need to transition from a worship, or rather a song leader, to a worship leader in order to prepare for excellence. I'm going to tell you, how much time do I have? What time was I supposed to finish? Because I got always more stories. No, I want to save time for the other presentations. Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll stop there. Any questions? Maybe we'll work one in, some illustrations in later on. Any questions on any of this? And like I said, this is the hardest thing in the world to explain. You've got to experience it. Yes, ma'am. Sure, we'll comment on. Excellent point. Let me say it for the tape. Concerned about the fact that we didn't mention the presence of Christ. Beautiful. Let me add the point, because you're absolutely right. God is present no matter how we worship. But for most people, if it's a ritualistic worship, they never become aware of God's presence. It's not just God's presence. He's present no matter how you worship, no matter how pathetic you do it. He may not be pleased, He's present. What?
To me, one of the points should be that for me, when I walk into the assembly, even if someone spoke to me, I might recognize Christ there and what's being led.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. I do not deny anyone's experience. What I'm trying to do is give you a general understanding of what helps a larger number of people come to the awareness of God's presence. Because today, God, first thing I said to you, I said, God, people don't really just want to hear more about God. They want to experience God. Brought into the presence of God. That's the very first thing I said. Remember that? So I did say it. That's the very first thing I said. And all I was doing is showing you ways to help people. Here is an erroneous attitude. That you and I are alone, by ourselves, responsible for how we interact with worship. 1 Corinthians 14 proves that absolutely wrong. Yes, you are responsible to come and to worship and to give yourself. But Paul clearly shows you that the reality is this. The church is responsible to assist you in being edified and experiencing the presence of God. That's what he said. You can destroy a person's ability to experience God. That's what they were doing. Speaking in tongues. They were coming together. See, house groups were coming together and they were eating their meals separate and were dishonoring the poor. And yet they would worship. They'd come together and finally worship. Well, they were all responsible to bring their own heart to worship. But Paul Berg says, listen, church leaders, you're responsible to help these people. You see, here's the thing. Here's what happens so often that I see, and it doesn't matter whether it's worship or groups or the development of converts. We think, well, if they're really convinced and committed, well, they'd do this and they'd do that. That's a pass-the-buck attitude. What I'm here to do is to share with the church leaders, okay, yes, it's their responsibility, but listen, you are responsible to do everything you can to improve the chances of the maturing of people in Christ through worship, through service, through ministry. Do you hear what I'm saying? I think the church should stop passing the buck and say, oh, it's the individual's responsibility, not ours. All we got to do is perfunctorily go through these things, and then if they didn't get anything out of worship, it's their problem. Or if the young people are bored, oh, they're just not mature. No. We're responsible to do it in a way that brethren are edified. It's the church's responsibility. It's the leader's responsibility. And that's what I've been trying to get across. I've been not denying a thing you say because you're right. Experiencing God's presence is what you want. Yes?
I was shifting a little bit, but I was wondering if you could comment on some recent articles and some books that have come out about Orthodox worship, that style of a very mystical sort of worship thing, as being something very attractive to Generation Xers. And our style of worship is far from being mystical and far from being
right. That which mm-hmm. you understand.
What,
yes.
Is that a trend that is just a blip?
Yeah, it's a minuscule trend.
A minuscule?
Yeah, very minuscule. But let me tell you, no matter what style you've got, you'll find somebody attracted to it to some degree. Okay? Yes, some Generation X is attracted to ritualism. But the majority are turned off by it. You do not see any of the mainline churches just exploding in growth through their pomp and ritual. That's a bunch of hot air. They're not there. Do some show up? Yes. But great numbers, like we see, moving to the independent churches? No way. So it's a minuscule trend. And it wouldn't even fit us, because I can't imagine us adopting a liturgical style, no matter what, you know, strategy, because that's really against our cultural position in the church.
I guess there was an article in Christianity Today, and from that writer's perspective, he was seeing it as something that